Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that where markets are concerned, it's not easy to detect the difference between objective and subjective reality, or between reality and fantasy? The business's view of the consumer has serious bottom line implications. At Plus 94 Research, we help businesses cut through the uncertainty by gathering and processing real consumer intelligence through advanced scientific research methodologies. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
A very good morning to you and welcome to this week's installment of Beyond Governance here at 101.9 High FM. I'm truly honored once again to be in your midst and sharing this time with you, the beloved listener. My name is Nimrod Mbele. As we all know, the elections are literally 2 weeks away from now. And before we cast our votes, it is important for us to really understand what is that we, you know, casting our votes for. We've got about 35 political parties who will be contesting the national and provincial elections. And I hope you've done your research on a party of your choice. This opposition is more relevant, particularly to the new voters. We do need fresh blood. We need fresh thinking. We need voters who would certainly make it a point that we have a democratic dispensation that is based on meritocracy, wherein we've got appointment of ministers, deputy ministers, and DGs with clearly defined targets, performance and accountability culture. This is something that has been missing for a while now. Obviously, cautious of mistakes like many South Africans that the new government would not repeat the same mistakes of the previous administration, where a culture of impunity was rampant, corruption was rampant. We all know that those kinds of issues. We do need a government that will clean up all this mess and really put the country back to its positive trajectory, as it were. Before getting to the gist of our conversation, I just want to quickly thank the team that is laying the foundation for this particular show. Howard Feldman, thank you very much for keeping us intrigued. They're back on your show, on your radio tomorrow at the same time. Before we proceed with our conversation with my fellow guest here, I want to thank Craig Guthrie, who is the controller of the show, and last but not least, Harry Seleke, who is the producer of the show. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Moving along, if you missed any of our previous show, not despair, simply go to our website, download that particular podcast, or this one in particular, and your thoughts and views are most welcome via our socials, which is 34519, the Telegram is 0618951009, and your views and thoughts are most welcome via my Twitter handle, which is at Dr. Mbele. In today's conversation, we're putting the spotlight on the country's ailing economy, which desperately needs foreign and national direct investment to address the myriad of issues such as unemployment, electricity, supply, and so on and so forth. These are big ticket items which are threatening the democratic agenda. Without any waste of time, these are very complex issues which the new government or government in waiting would have to address. And in making sense of these issues, I'm joined by David Root, who's the chief economist at Efficient Group. David, thank you very much for gracing Beyond Governance with your presence.
And thank you very much for the invitation.
Absolutely. David, you've been around the block for some time. Perhaps maybe you could just give us your overview of the country's position from where you're sitting in terms of what you think are the sticky points that the new government would have to address.
Yeah, well, we all know about things like, for example, poverty in South Africa, unemployment in South Africa. We know that the economy is hardly growing. We know all about challenges like electricity and Transnet and that sort of stuff. But I think basically the challenges, the economic challenges, at least for South Africa, can be sort of distilled into three major challenges. The first one is the local authorities. Now, I can give you all sort of numbers on the local authorities, but the majority of our local authorities, something like 70% of our local authorities, are financially just not viable anymore. They are very deep in trouble financially. They are being mismanaged, and they owe a lot of money to, for example, Eskom. They owe something like 80 billion rand to Eskom. And that's part of the reason why Eskom is in deep trouble as well. So the local authorities are crucially important, and they because that's the first port of call if you start a business. You need electricity and water and a pavement, and the local authorities are supposed to be to provide you with those. So that is challenge number one, local authorities. Challenge number two are the state-owned enterprises. Now, the state-owned enterprises, we know about Eskom and Transnet and a lot, but just about all the state-owned enterprises have been run into the ground financially and operationally. They owe huge amounts of money, outstanding debt. They are basically bankrupt. And many of them are simply dying or coming to an end. The post office is a very good example of that. We've already seen the demise of South African Airways. We're currently seeing our Eskom is being taken apart, basically, and being privatized in a weird kind of way. Transnet is the most recent troubled child. So the state-owned enterprises are a major challenge. Then the third major challenge is the fiscal accounts, and that is what the Minister of Finance is responsible for. That is state debt. That is getting worse by the day because state debt keeps on going up. Minister of Finance keeps on borrowing more and more money because there's this huge pressure on the Minister of Finance to spend more and more money. But the revenue sources of the Minister of Finance are getting under more and more pressure, and that is simply because the economy is not growing. Tax revenue is under pressure. Just about all the revenue. It's interesting to analyze the various tax sources to the Minister of Finance, but the bottom line basically is that the Minister of Finance simply does not have more scope to increase his revenue from an economy that is hardly growing. So I would say those are the three major challenges. Of course, within those major challenges are things like education and things like policing and so on, but I think you can categorize as those three challenges. Now, that is why the election is so important, because we have to ask the question of why we are where we are when you look at those three major problems that I've identified. And I think the answer to that is can be laid in front of the door of the ANC government. The ANC government has done immense damage to the South African economy on those three points that I've mentioned, and of course more. And if there's another ANC government, then of course don't expect them to manage the South African economy differently. It's probably will be business as usual, and business as usual is not a good thing. So it's important to think about what the outcome of the election is going to look like. It is probably going to include an ANC. The ANC will be part of whoever's going to be in government. But the real question is who are going to be the opposition or the partners in the ANC for a coalition government going forward. And I think we are talking about the real possibility of a coalition going forward. And that will determine in the way that those three challenges will be addressed by the new government.
Thank you very much for that overview, which is quite interesting. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that where markets are concerned, it's not easy to detect the difference between objective and subjective reality, or between reality and fantasy? The business's view of the consumer has serious bottom-line implications. At Plus 94 Research, we help businesses cut through the uncertainty by gathering and processing real consumer intelligence through advanced scientific research methodologies. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision-making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. I'm in company of W. Rose, who is the chief economist at Deficient Group, talking about how to turn around the economy, which is quite ailing. We all know that unemployment rate is the highest in the world. We know that we've got energy challenges. Before we took that short break, David gave us a very good overview of what it defines and three critical pillars of which needs to be turned around. First and foremost, he gave us a start around the local authorities or municipalities, which are technically bankrupt, owing Eskom about 80 billion rands. He also gave us insight on the state-owned entities, which are also very bankrupt and dying. And the last point that he gave us is the fiscal account. We all know that the revenue is down. If the revenue is down, fiscals, there's not much money going around from the fiscal point of view, which means we have to borrow. We borrow at obviously huge interest rates, and we obviously get in more and more into debt, which brings one big question. I mean, we know that business has been business very critical and influencing partner in government policies and so on and so forth. We have seen how Business Unity South Africa partnering with government. What has that yielded Is there any positive outlook that we're seeing emerging? Because I know there's a lot of business folk, business community hard at work, but we haven't really seen much in the form of investments that they have poured into the economy.
Yes. No, in fact, the private sector is getting more and more involved. And certainly the private sector, I know there's this initiative by the private sector to assist where they can, and they are a couple of priorities. But I think more importantly is what's been happening at other levels, and that is not necessarily this. I'm not necessarily referring to this this attempt by the president to get the private sector involved. I think it's happening sort of naturally, and what I mean by that is that, for example, I think electricity is a very good example, is that if you want electricity in South Africa today, you either have to generate your own electricity or you're going to be without electricity. That's a good example. And what is happening is that the private sector is getting involved in the generation of electricity. Now, initially, the Minister of Energy, Gwede Mantashe, he said that he didn't want the private sector to generate electricity. Then he said, okay, they can generate 10 megawatts. And then he said 20 and then 50, and now they can generate as much as they like. The point I want to make here is that the state actually does not want the private sector to get involved in things like, for example, the generation of electricity. But what is happening is that the reality simply is catching up with the ideology of the ANC. And the reality is that if you don't allow the private sector to participate in these sort of things, then you're not going to have it. And exactly the same is happening at Transnet. I actually like the new CEO at Transnet. She's doing an excellent job, because initially Transnet said, listen, you have to invest so many billions, and then we will give you a contract of 2 or 3 years to run that specific rail track, for example. And the private sector is just not interested in something like this, because you're talking about many billions of rands, and nobody is going to invest that amount of money if you only have a 2 or 3 year contract. Now, what the Transnet is doing now, they're talking about 20 and even 30 years contracts. So that is what is happening. So kicking and screaming, the ANC in government in South Africa is doing what is supposed to be happening. Is that get the private sector involved in many of these things. Even when you talk about the ports, we are actually talking about the privatization of the ports. There's an international company that's very much interested in taking over the running of many of our ports in South Africa. So again, you know, like I've said, kicking and screaming, the ANC government is allowing the private sector to start getting involved in many things that the state previously had the monopoly over. And that certainly is a good thing. Unfortunately, the process to get there, why is it that there had to be such a fight about how much electricity private sector can generate? Why is it that initially that Transnet did not allow for longer term contracts? Why is it that we waited until now before we actually get the private sector to start running the ports, as an example? Because there's so much lost economic potential that you can never regain. You can never go back to yesterday to catch up on lost economic growth of yesterday. So we've lost a lot of economic growth and potential the last couple of years, and eventually we start moving in the right direction. But at least we are moving in the right direction. I'm just a little bit concerned about who's going to be in our next government, whether they will continue on this new trend. And maybe I can just make the comment, this new trend, this new, let's call it the new policy of the ANC, is not part of the ANC's ideology. They're actually against these sort of things. But like I've said, reality is catching up with ideology.
No, it's quite interesting that it boils down to ideology, and the new thought process obviously is more on liberalization of the economy by bringing more and more private sector players into areas where the state used to have monopoly. You're talking, rail state had 100% monopoly. Yeah. SOEs, the state had 100% monopoly. And perhaps maybe that's a very good reason as to why, most of the SOEs are bankrupt. Obviously, take out corruption, take out maladministration. My sense from your end is that ideology has played a significant role in the ruins that we are seeing.
Yes and no. And let me tell you why I say so. There are a couple of very ideologically very, very strong-minded individuals in the ANC. Now, I can give you two names, for example. Pravin Gordhan is a very good example. He's a real ideologue. Ebrahim Patel, he's another real. They are real communists. which is completely wrong ideology in a modern world. But they are real bleeding heart communists, and there's no way you're going to convince them that the ideology of communism, certainly their version of communism, simply does not fit in a modern world. So they are real ideologues. So from that point of view, the ANC is pretty much driven by ideology. But I think the majority of ANC, let's call them cadres, really don't give, they don't care about ideology. Many of them, unfortunately, many of them are simply there for the ride. Many of them are simply there to enrich themselves. So we've got the combination of the wrong ideology, and then we have and then we've got this many members in the ANC, and I guess in government also, that do not care about ideology. They're simply there for the right. And I think the combination of this is really a toxic combination. So yes, ideology in a way, but ideology also not.
It's quite an interesting observation that you obviously had a fair balance in terms of, because there's, you know, it is just a matter of how liberalization is being carried out. We know we have other countries where, ideology is not, it's more socialist in its orientation, and yet there is still productivity, there's still progress, yeah, there's still development. So we can't really paint everything with the same brush. I mean, I do take your point that the extremes in your particular instance, Pravin Gordhan as an ideologue, as an example, but surely, policy, government policy is not driven by an individual, it's driven by the collective. How do you explain that?
Yeah, maybe, yes, it's supposed to be driven by the collective, but I think in the case of South Africa, that is perhaps part of the problem. And I think Cyril Ramaphosa is a very good example of that. Cyril Ramaphosa is not a good president. He's not a good president because he simply does not take decisions. And sometimes you need somebody to take the lead. He's a pleaser. He's a collective guy. And sometimes you need a leader. That's what you're supposed to be. And I can give you many examples where Cyril Ramaphosa is supposed to make decisions. A very good one now is the NHI, the National Health Insurance. He's still waiting for his pen. He's looking for his pen to sign legislation. So that's an example of an indecisive president. But something else that I think is important, and the comment that you made, remember, if you look at the ANC started off with this very strong leftish ideology 30 years ago. But in practice, what happened is that they actually moved quite a lot to the right, and they did fairly right-wing stuff, like, for example, privatization and that sort of stuff. And the result of that was fairly strong economic growth the first couple of years of ANC rule. Then things started going horribly wrong, especially the past 15 years or so. And the ANC moved to the left quite markedly, especially the last, say, 15 years or so. But you made a comment also that there are socialist countries that are doing well economically. I must disagree with you on that, because if you are referring to countries like, I don't know, but I guess you could be referring to countries like the Nordic countries, as an example, as socialist countries. Are those the countries that you're referring to?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at France is a more socialist country, obviously, in a context of democracy. You look at South Korea. It has a very strong element of socialism, because you look at how the country addresses the vast majority in terms of lifting up everybody. Those are kinds of policy nuggets which are more leftist that are there.
No. I think maybe we you and I do not agree necessarily about the definition for socialism. My definition for socialism is where the state owns a lot of the economy, where the state owes a lot of assets or factors of production, economists call that. And if you look, for example, at the countries like France or the Nordic countries, what you find there is that the taxes are quite high, in fact, very high. In many countries. But what happens is that they tax the private sector, and they take this money and they give it back to the private sector to spend on certain things. The government or the state does not own the factories and the mines and the businesses. That belongs to the private sector. Taxes could be high. The means of production, that belongs to the private sector. And the same goes for countries like, for example, South Korea and so on. In fact, if you look at countries like, for example, China, the last, say, 30 years, we saw this explosion of economic growth in China, and that is as they moved away from socialism more to a free market-orientated economy. They're doing the opposite at the moment, by the way. Xi Jinping is trying to move back to real socialism, but the reason for this explosion in economic growth in China was because they adopted a more free market approach. And the result, we all know what happened in China, for example. So I think the question, it's a definitional thing. What do you mean by socialism? Okay. If you mean high taxes, if that is socialist, then certainly the French will be socialist. But if you talk about the ownership of the means of production, then the French are not socialists.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that most statistics for commercial and social research are tested for accuracy at a 95% confidence level? As specialists in the field, we do tests between 90 and 99% confidence levels. This is not to be confused with our name. Plus 94 is a celebration of the miracle post 94 in South Africa. We can still test the accuracy of your data at 94%. It is in our name to give you the confidence you need. Plus 94 Research. The science of decision-making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. I'm in company of W. Rose, who is the chief economist at Division Group, talking about how to turn around the economy. Well, I suppose it's more really the pendulum, how far on the right or left you go. But anyway, let's move to one point that you raised, because you can have a policy. Policy is driven by people. What is your overview of the skills and capacities or capabilities that is missing? Because you could have all this, even if you could have a highly liberalized policy regime, so to speak, but in some instances where you've got state-owned entities, depending on the shareholding, blocks and so forth, you still need highly competent, you still need technically inclined people, you still need people who obviously are versed with the new way of thinking. Issues around accountability are important. Yeah. Issues around fit for purpose in terms of skills and competencies are important, and which means there has to be a way in which we invest in those kind of skill sets. Where are we in this country, and what is a mischief?
Let me use an example. We're all talking, and I just mentioned the NHI, that the president is still looking for his pen. But the NHI is not going to happen. And the NHI is not going to happen for three reasons. The first one is there isn't money. There just isn't money. And I did speak about the national accounts, the fiscal accounts. And there's no way that we can increase taxes significantly in order to fund the NHI. So that's point number one. Point number two, the NHI is probably, and I'm not a legal expert, but it's probably, as it stands at the moment, unconstitutional at various levels. And that means that if the president does find his pen, he's going to be in court for probably for many years or decades even. So that's another thing, a reason why the NHI is not going to happen. A third reason why the NHI is not going to happen is that a good thing about having an incompetent government quite often is that they cannot implement a bad idea either. And that's the point you're making, is that we simply do not have the skills and the capacity in the civil service, generally speaking, to do the things that they promise they're going to do. Something that's very close to my heart is education, as an example. Now, we spend more on education than most countries in the world, in absolute and in the relative term. Education is by far the most important expenditure item for the Minister of Finance. So money is not the issue when it comes to education. But if you compare South Africa's quality of education to the rest of the world, we are quite often not bad, but we're quite often the worst in the world, stone last in the world. I'm talking about the TIMSS study and the PIRLS study and so on. So it's without a doubt, money is not the problem. The quality that you get is really, really horrible. Now that impacts the quality of education in South Africa. The skills development impacts hugely on the economy, because you need skilled people to grow the economy, especially the service side of the economy, especially the technologically part of the economy. You need that in the private sector, but you need it in civil service as well. And we don't get that because of the quality of our skills development in South Africa. Perhaps just a side comment about skills development in South Africa. I analyze the fiscal accounts quite a lot, and I look at things like, for example, personal income taxes, which is the most important revenue source to the Minister of Finance. And there are a couple of very interesting things going on in personal income taxes. We know we've got a very skewed income distribution in South Africa. But what happens with those few people with good skills in South Africa, they can actually demand quite significant increases in their wages, because they can simply sell their labor or their skills internationally. And because they are well qualified, they can demand and they can negotiate nice salary increases. There's those skilled people in the country, and you can actually see that personal income taxes for those people are going up because their salaries are going up. But that also means that the gap between those skilled people and the people without skill, and there are and many people without proper skills in the South African economy, that the gap between the income is increasing. So the inequality in South Africa is increasing because of that. Another interesting thing, if you analyze personal income taxes, is that there are many, what they call them, swallows. And that's people that literally work internationally. And I always use this example. I've got a friend that works for a bank in Kenya. He's never even been to Kenya because he simply logs on like you and I now, talk on the internet with the meetings, and he works through the internet and all that. And you find more and more of those people coming to South Africa and like to work in South Africa because of the wonderful weather and all the other wonderful wine and stuff that we have in South Africa. And they pay taxes in South Africa. And perhaps that's an opportunity for us. But I think the point I want to make, skills, a shortage of skills, inferior skills development in South Africa, all that is fueling a state that is simply incapable of doing many things in the economy, and that is also contributing to the huge inequality that we have currently in the country.
You've raised a very number of very interesting point, which I, because you don't have enough time, I really want to get your thoughts around. I mean, first and foremost, the issue around the indecisiveness of the president. That's one point, and in a kind of competing priorities, you do need somebody to not to be a fence sitter, so to speak, someone who takes decision, irrespective of how unpopular those decisions can be, because we can't, we have to catch up. That's all number one. And I'm sure most sort of South Africans will agree with you in that particular issue. The other issue that you raised is about the fact that education is the highest cost driver in the fiscus, and yet the quality, in your view, it is not of the similar standard compared to other African countries, even European countries that spend a sizable amount of money in education. You may reference to Pearls and TIMSS as an example in terms of indicators of where we are. The skills inferiority, which is the next point that I wanted to your thoughts around, because we have CETAs. We've got about, 25 or so CETAs?
Yeah, a lot
Of them. Most core businesses is to align the quality or the aligned curriculum with the demands of the market. For the past 8 years or so, surely by now, and it's not rocket science, that the skills, the CETAs ought to be trailblazers in bringing in bringing in some level of international standard in relation to what else is needed by the market. Why is it that the CETAs haven't really been there? And over and above that, here's another caveat. We have a very strong private sector investment in the CETA by way of the levies. Surely if private sector was playing its role in relation to influencing government on where the money ought to be spent, surely by now they would have directed the CETA's policy regime to a point where it speaks to the demand side of the market.
Yeah, that's very good. Very good. I don't really have an answer to that. The only answer I have to that is that the CETAs, some of them are working quite well, I must say. But I think in the end, the CETAs are under the control of the ANC government as well, in a way. Of course, the private sector participates in that, and the private sector contributes to that and claims against that. And the private sector is supposed to make use of this to train people. But maybe we're running out of time, I realize that. But maybe I can just make this comment. That, and this is another silver lining. And that is, if you look at the nature of economic activity in the world and also in South Africa and where economic growth is taking place, it's taking place in a service industry and the technologically driven part of the economy. And there is actually a revolution underway in the industry of education. And that is because of, I think COVID actually accelerated that, but there are a couple of industries that I really like, and education is certainly one of them, because today it is possible for a person in the poorest part of the world to get absolutely world-class education, provided you have a computer and a good internet connection, of course the skills to work that computer. Then you can get the best education that the world can offer you because of the way of technology developed over time. And that's one of the industries that I really, really fancy, and that is education. And I think all these problems that we are facing in terms of skills development in South Africa, many of those problems will be addressed because of the technological advances recently, and education is one of those industries that will benefit hugely from that.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a second.
Beyond Governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa, is proudly sponsored by Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.
Did you know that most statistics for commercial and social research are tested for accuracy at a 95% confidence level? As specialists in the field, we do tests between 90 and 99% confidence levels. This is not to be confused with our name. Plus 94 is a celebration of the miracle post 94 in South Africa. We can still test the accuracy of your data at 94%. It is in our name to give you the confidence you need. Plus 94 Research. The science of decision making.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. I'm in the company of W. Rose, who is the chief economist at Division Group, talking about how to turn around the economy. Thank you very much. I think those are very interesting points that you have made. And I certainly want to have you once again, because you have a number of thought-provoking issues that you've raised with us, which would be of benefit to the listener if you delve more and more into them, because the reality is that these are very complex and complicated issues, and which requires a deeper and a systemic analysis. A brain such as yourself can add value in terms of and not only articulating the challenges, but providing solutions, because these kinds of show are actually meant to sensitize or widen the perspective of the listener on what are some of the solutions which not only government, but private sector, because private sector has been dominant. And we can't simply blame government, wherein private sector have a very strong voice and have had a very strong voice in the past. And yes, they're not really as vociferous as they should be, you know, particularly in the context of aiding in economy.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It will be absolutely my pleasure to talk to you again. And I really enjoyed this as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was David Root, who's the chief economist at Efficient Group. How I wish I would have more time with the brains like that. It has been absolutely a pleasure having you, David.
Thank you.
Yep. We have a very interesting observation inside from Davi in as far as how you turn around the economy. In his view, he gave us two critical pillars which the impending government has to address. Obviously, the local government, which is in a mess. 70% of them are completely dysfunctional because they don't have revenue. They owe Eskom about 80 billion rands, let alone ordinary citizens who obviously adds to that kind of fiasco. And we all know that SOEs are completely in a mess. They've been run down. They're also in debt. And every other year, they go to government cap in hand to try and ask for rescue. And there's, strategic SOEs such as Transnet and SAA, well, not so much strategic in a broader context of mobility, but Transnet and Eskom are obviously quite critical. Personally, there has to be a way in which the SOE environment it is reconfigured. The impending bill on SOE landscape potentially has the possibility or capability of redefining the landscape of SOEs, provided there's a radical shift in terms of the ethos and the mindset, which is required. This is something that we all have to keep our eyes on so that we are able to distance, ourselves from ideology, because based on Davi's point and numerous, commentators who are technocrats in their own space, they have identified ideology as one of the, albatross, it's more the appropriate expression, on our necks, which has to be redone. Issues around skills and inferiority of skills, that's definitely a big issue that needs to be addressed. I'm sure there's been pockets of excellence which has been done, particularly in the era of technology. We just need to bump those kinds of initiative further. Unfortunately, we're going to leave it here. It has been absolutely beautiful. Looking forward to have your views, and your thoughts and views are most welcome via my X handle, which is Dr. Mele. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on board. Have yourself a fantastic day ahead. Shalom.
Did you know that most statistics for commercial and social research are tested for accuracy at a 95% confidence level? As specialists in the field, we do tests between 90 and 99% confidence levels. This is not to be confused with our name. Plus 94 is a celebration of the miracle post 94 in South Africa. We can still test the accuracy of your data at 94%. It is in our name to give you the confidence you need. Plus 94 Research, the science of decision making.